Our Central Time news guy joins us each Friday to catch us up on the top stories in Wisconsin news and politics. Today, he's here for a look back on the top stories of the year and where we're headed in 2014.
Noah Obshinsky is the assistant news director here at Wisconsin Public Radio. And Noah, welcome back to the program.
It's good to be here. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday, indeed. And we've got a lot to talk about as we take a look back at 2013. We'll be here for the next half hour or so. And in terms of the big stories of the year, there are so many to start with, but let's start with mining laws, because
sure,
it's interesting, because mining laws actually go back a couple years. We were talking about it was sort of there and it wasn't, then all of a sudden this year it was back, and back with in a real big way.
Yeah, it all sort of came to a head actually early this year. I have to say, for a non-election year, this was a very interesting year from a news perspective, both with all the policy changes that took place, as well as the hot debates that we had both in the legislature and in the communities around Wisconsin. You mentioned mining, and that was really one of the first things that really took off in 2013. Basically, what it was the complete revamping of the state's mining laws. The legislature passed and the governor signed changes in March. And basically what it did was it streamlined the mine application process. It allowed, you know, waste rock, which is part of the mining process, to be dumped into small bodies of water like streams and rivers and things like that. And that was a very controversial piece of legislation that did pass in March.
And this came from a lot of the fire behind this was from the proposed iron mine in northern Wisconsin. This wasn't just these old mining laws are kind of dusty. Let's check them out.
Right, exactly. I mean, for me, as far as 2013 is concerned, this really was the opening salvo in this ongoing debate over the proposed mine in the Pinoki Hills. Supporters of the bill, of course, at the time and still do say that, you know, this is a valuable job creation bill, legislation, you know, that there is a lot of potential jobs and economic advantages to having mining in an area like the Pinoki Hills. Critics, of course, cited the environmental protections that were, from their point of view, were weakened by the legislation that was passed in March.
Now, it's interesting if you go back far enough and you remember that initial mining legislation that got turned. Gogebic said it was moving out of the state, wasn't coming back. They knew when they weren't wanted and all that. Then all of a sudden, this legislation gets passed. They're back in northern Wisconsin all of a sudden, and boy, fireworks.
Yeah, I mean, this legislation was basically tailor-made to bring them in, you know, bring them back to the state and for them to begin the process of mining up in the Pinoki Hills. There's no doubt about it. Of course, this may apply to future mining projects if there are, but for the sake of 2013, what we're really talking about is Gogebic Taconite's proposed mine in the Pinoki Hills. And really what that legislation did in March is just, I think, set off the dominoes for the rest of the year as far as the debate is concerned.
And Noah, we've spent a lot of these Friday sessions looking at the various sub-controversies around the overall big picture of this mine. So give us some of the highlights of what has happened since that mining legislation passed.
Right. So I think they're basically, and of course, this is a very complicated issue, but I'll pick out three notable things. One is there has been debate over the access to this site, because, as you might remember, protesters back in the summer raided the mine site and harassed the workers. There was a videotape of that later surfaced, and it was very controversial. What that led to was the company, Gogebic Taconite, hiring a private security firm to guard this site in the Pinoki Hills. And soon pictures of that surfaced that showed very heavily armed paramilitary types guarding the mine area. And that in of itself was controversial because people were startled to see pictures of heavily armed folks in the woods in northern Wisconsin. And the controversy continued from there after it was revealed that that security company wasn't licensed to operate in Wisconsin. And that in of itself was a controversy. And based on this access issue, just fast forward to a few weeks ago, the governor signed legislation that allows the DNR to close off more land around that site if they find that the situation has become unsafe either for the mine workers or for the public. This legislation also created a 600-foot buffer around the roads and equipment that happens with mining. So there's this issue of access to this site that has been really a very hot debate over the course of the last year.
And speaking of access, one of the things we haven't talked about in terms of this is that the whole harvest camp that is sort of right in the middle of it all right now.
Right. So the Lac-Courtier, not long after Gogebic Taconite started sampling up there and started their operations, the Lac-Courtier tribe established what they're calling a harvest camp, which has really been one of the centers of protest, where both tribal members from a variety of tribes, as well as people just from Wisconsin and other states, it's a place that, according to the tribe, people can come and learn about the environment, learn about the plants and the animals and things like that. It's also been really a place where protesters have come and spent time. And that in and of itself has been controversial because while they've been on this county land, this county forest land, there are officials in Iron County who would like to evict them because they feel like they're essentially camping and have been there too long. So that's another issue. You know, what right do the Lac-Courtier and other tribes have on this county forest land? What right do they have to protest the mine in that way?
And then another, you mentioned the sampling in that area. One of the things sampling turned up was some kind of asbestos-like fibers, and that's been another source of criticism from people who want to stop the mining project.
Right. So we've talked about access to the site. We've talked about the harvest camp, which has been controversial. And now there's this issue of what's actually in the soil, what's in the rock. And scientists and the DNR have found evidence of what they're calling asbestos-like fibers in the area that Gogebic Taconite would like to mine. And that, you know, that could complicate efforts because that may limit what they can do. It certainly affects the permitting process. It may complicate things for the company. And gentlemen, let's not kid ourselves. You know, Gogebic Taconite isn't going to be mining for this stuff in a few months. This is a long process, and we're really just really in the beginning of this whole thing. And so it'll be interesting to see how this issue of asbestos-like fibers, how that may affect the permitting process in the future.
And then in 2014, we'll be watching probably for the federal government, right, to see what they say, the Army Corps of Engineers, the EPA.
Right. There is some question as to whether or not the Army Corps of Engineers is going to take part in all of the environmental assessments that need to be done because the requirements, the federal requirements and the state requirements may be different. And so there's even a question of what agencies are going to be involved and how involved are they going to be in that process. That could lead to delays, litigation, you name it. We're just in the beginning of this thing.
So if I could have a joke here for a second, if we're not going to be mining iron ore anytime soon, we'll be mining some great news stories in the next couple of years.
Yeah, absolutely. The story is not going away.
And what's the joke, Gene?
Thank you for that.
I kid.
Another story that was very big this year is the whole issue of the University of Wisconsin system and reserve funding. And the big question there is, what is a proper level of reserves?
Right. And every so often, you know, the UW system does make news as far as its relationship to the state legislature. And in 2013, the issue was over cash reserves. And more specifically, as you just mentioned, you know, how much the system had at a time when the system had been raising tuition and was looking to raise tuition even further.
And as part of that process, UW officials were sort of called on the carpet, I guess you'd say, before the legislature and asked some very direct questions about where did the money come from, what are you planning to do with it, and it led to some other studies. I think Audit Bureau got involved and things like that.
Right. So what sort of started this was a memo from the Legislative Fiscal Bureau that essentially showed that the system had these reserves. And some leaders in the state legislature felt that they basically had said that they were played by the system, that they were essentially duped into helping pay for this reserve with tuition money. System officials defended the reserve itself. You know, they said that, you know, they needed a reserve as far as to plan ahead for the uncertainty that can come with, you know, enrollment changes, changes in state support, which is always changing, things of that nature. But they did acknowledge at the time, the president of the UW system did acknowledge that they were not as transparent as they could have been about the existence of these, you know, this fund balance that was spread across, you know, thousands of accounts in the UW system.
Right. Kevin Riley was on this show, the outgoing system president, and said, this wasn't a secret. You know, we didn't tally up and write down a total number for the entire UW system, but there was no concealed information. He was making the case.
Right. And if you look at the numbers, you know, it was roughly 25% or so of the total budget. And UW officials pointed out at the time and continue to that, you know, that's at the low end of what similar systems keep around as far as a rainy day fund. You know, and so the question will be, as you say, Gene, moving forward is, you know, what is the proper amount of reserves as far as the UW is concerned, as far as the state legislature is concerned? What is the proper amount? And, you know, they're going to have to deal with that here in the coming months. They're obviously going to be looking at best practices around the country and come up with their own numbers.
All right. We're talking to Noah Obshinsky. He is WPR's assistant news director, and we are discussing some of the top Wisconsin news stories from 2013.
Healthcare will be one of the issues we get to in a few minutes. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org. What's your big Wisconsin story for 2013 and looking ahead at 2014? Where do you think issues like the iron mine will end up? Call 800-642-1234.
We continue our conversation about some of the top stories of 2013 in Wisconsin with WPR's Noah Obshinsky.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on the top Wisconsin story of the year. That's 800-642-1234. Before we move on, Noah, I wanted to look ahead a little bit on that story of the UW Reserve and the controversy that came out in the legislature.
Right. So one of the biggest effects, really, of that whole debate was the fact that the UW system, who had originally hoped to raise tuition by 2%, I think, in each of the next 2 years, lawmakers included a freeze in tuition. And so, you know, students and their families will be enjoying a tuition freeze as a result of that controversy.
Another big story this year we've heard a lot about has to do with health care, and specifically in Wisconsin, how it is funded. And it gets more complicated because the whole Obamacare issue runs throughout this. And so Governor Walker has made some decisions here that some other governors are making around the country. Some are, some aren't. But here in Wisconsin, it's turning into a big deal lately.
Right. Obviously, two things here, guys. One is everybody's talking about health care reform because every state is dealing with federal health care insurance, you know, reform differently. And we'll call it Obamacare. And secondly, you know, what Governor Walker has done in Wisconsin is really a departure from his predecessors. Previous, you know, Governors Doyle and Thompson, you know, they expanded Badger Care as a whole. What Governor Walker has done is really redefine the program. And what he basically has said is this is going to be a program for people below the poverty level. And so what Walker's plan has been and what's going to happen here pretty soon, as soon as the website, the federal website kind of works out, is to move 90,000 people off Badger Care and onto private plans offered through the online exchanges. And at the same time, Walker would like to move childless adults into Badger Care. So really significant changes to this program. You know, the governor and his GOP colleagues in the state legislature argued that this was the most effective way to get people responsible for their insurance. You know, they said that the federal government couldn't be trusted to help pay for the Medicaid changes that the federal government wanted the states like Wisconsin to make. Democrats, social service groups criticized the move to move 90,000 people off Badger Care because basically they said, you know, they can't afford necessarily the insurance offered on the marketplace, even with the federal subsidies. So they're still going to be struggling to get insurance now that they're off Badger Care.
And with the complications with the Obamacare website, this is a story that it keeps changing a little bit. I mean, the general premise remains the same, but it seems as though the Walker administration is having to make modifications as they go, sort of in reaction to what's happening at the national level.
Right. Because of the flawed rollout of the federal website, what has happened is the governor and the legislature has moved forward to delay these changes. And the governor actually has just recently said that he'd be willing to delay it further, say, in April, if the website continues to have significant problems and people can't sign up for these private plans.
I want to take a caller now who wants to share an important story for him this year in Wisconsin. Richard in Huntley, Illinois is with us. Richard, hi.
Hi. Yeah, that's great. I'm calling because the International Crane Foundation out of Baraboo, Wisconsin, which is doing tremendous work for Wisconsin conservation and the world, has celebrated their 40th anniversary. And George Archbold is the person that put that all together 40 years ago, and it's impacted Wisconsin hugely with conservation and habitat restoration. And it's one of the stories that sometimes gets overlooked, but they're really a really healthy economy for Baraboo and the surrounding areas.
All right. Thanks for sharing that, Richard. And I believe that was covered on the Larry Miller Show and the Joy Cardine Show. But if nobody's talked to them lately, Central Time might be due for a look at the International Crane Foundation. And Noah, another caller didn't stay on, said the top story of 2013 is still the fallout from Act 10. Its effects still linger and will continue to be a factor in next year's election. Well, one of the many threads of fallout from that, arrests at the state capitol in the ongoing protests that started back with Act 10.
Right. So in the summer of this year, Capitol Police began really what can only be called a crackdown, really, on the protesters that had been meeting nearly every day, almost, since the governor moved forward on his legislation, very controversial legislation. And at the time, what they had done was they cited a recent court ruling that essentially, as the police and the Department of Administration interpreted the ruling, at least, allowed them to arrest people that gathered at the Capitol in groups larger than 20, specifically those that gathered without a permit. And so what happened was, starting in July and for many weeks afterwards, groups of protesters were arrested at the Capitol. And what started really as a small group over the course of those weeks actually grew as the arrests grew.
And what are we seeing these days? I mean, it's been in and out and sort of through the courts. If I wanted to go protest now or if I wanted to sing, what do I have to do?
Well, basically, after a lot of controversy and court involvement, basically what the Department of Administration and attorneys for the protesters settled on basically was that the protesters wouldn't necessarily have to take out a permit. The permit process remains, but they wouldn't necessarily have to take out a permit to gather. But what police are asking is that the protesters tell them when they plan to protest and how many people they expect to show up, so they have some idea of what to expect as far as the police are concerned. And as far as the daily protests, you know, since then, you know, I would say we're down close to, if not at, pre-arrest numbers when it comes to the protesters that are currently at the Capitol.
And forgive me for not knowing, and maybe you don't know the answer to this, are there any court cases outstanding as a result of this?
The one question mark that remains, as far as I know it, is what to do with the people who have already been cited by the police, the status of those cases, and I think that's still unclear.
You know, we talked about mining earlier in the program, but that was in regards to mining, iron ore mining, basically. But there's a whole bunch of other mining, frac sand. You know, 5 years ago, I couldn't have picked up frac sand anywhere on anything. I wouldn't have known what it was. All of a sudden, it turns out we have a lot of frac sand mining operations in Wisconsin.
It is a big industry, and it is one that is growing almost by the day. One of the things that happened this year was that lawmakers floated a piece of legislation that really dramatically limits the ability of local governments to regulate the frac sand industry. Because what's happened is, since frac sand industry has, as you mentioned, taken the state by storm, what has happened is individual counties and townships and others have taken it upon themselves to regulate the industry.
So they've done through zoning and that sort of thing.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Air quality, water quality, hours of operation. Some counties have even passed moratoriums for new frac sand industries while they study the industry further. So a lot of this has taken place in the county and at the township level. And what some lawmakers want to do is really limit their ability to regulate the industry because from their perspective, they don't like this patchwork of regulations. They would like all the frac sand businesses to be essentially playing by the same playbook, the same level of regulation, no matter where they are in the state. And that's what the sponsors of this very controversial piece of legislation would like to do.
Yeah, and I'm imagining that a lot of the local governments see this as a direct threat on their ability to zone their own, you know, the lands that they have.
Absolutely. They see this as an attack on local control. Environmentalists hate this bill because it limits the ability of the local governments to deal with the air and water quality issues that have come up with this really growing industry.
So is it catching fire? Or, I mean, what's the bill look like?
Yeah, we'll see. You know, there may be some action in the spring, but right now it's unclear. What is for sure is this is a very contentious piece of legislation, and we'll probably see it again sometime in 2014.
And we'll hear more about this. Rich Kramer, one of our WPR reporters, who's Mr. Frack Sand lately because he's in that part of the state, he's going to bring us up to date on the year in this growth industry and the controversy that surrounds it. That's Tuesday at 3 o'clock here on the show.
Very nice forward promotion, Rob.
Thank you.
Elsewhere in the state, education, big, big topic. Last couple of biennial budgets for sure. And one of the things we saw this year in Wisconsin is an expansion of voucher schools. And again, lots of controversy attendant to that.
Right. We talk about the big policy changes of 2013. This was one of them. Basically, this legislation was a dramatic shift in the status of voucher schools in the state, because what was limited to two cities is now essentially statewide. So really, it's a paradigm shift as far as education in the state.
But there are still limits on it. I mean, it's not an unlimited...
Right. For now, enrollment was capped at 500 for this school year, and I believe it's 1,000 for next year. But while there are these enrollment caps, it's unclear as to whether or not they will continue in the future. Basically, what happened was the Governor Walker and his colleagues in the state legislature essentially opened the floodgates for voucher schools in the state. And so whether or not these enrollment caps stay in place or whether they'll be changed, it's unclear. What we know now, though, is that voucher schools are statewide, and that's probably not going to change.
Well, Noah, we're just about out of time, but in not one of these stories that we've talked about has there been a period at the end of it. These are still works in progress looking ahead.
Right, absolutely. I'd say as far as the voucher schools issue is, you know, one of the big debates, and I think we'll see some debate in 2014, is how do we grade these schools? You know, how should they be compared to traditional public schools? So that'll be one of the things that I think we'll see some of in 2014.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us today. Noah Ovshinsky, WPR's Assistant News Director.